Hi, and welcome to Revision Media. Here live with me, Paul Edward Stevenson, on this Monday, the 10th of May, 2021. Welcome to the show. I'll be with you here through till 5 p.m. here, my time in the UK. That's 11 till 12 Central Time and midday till 1 p.m. Eastern Time, wherever you are around the world. Welcome. Also, of course, I will be live with Richard Carey on Beyond the Official Narrative in a couple of hours. On Republic Broadcasting Network from 6 p.m. till 7 p.m. UK time, midday till 1 Central, 1 p.m. till 2 Eastern time. So do join me there as well. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about the economy. I'm going to play a little clip from Peter Schiff, who breaks it down quite eloquently and succinctly as well, what's been happening. But of course, you had apparent shock at the jobs report last week there that came out in the United States. It's laughable that anybody should be shocked, considering the amount of money that the government via the the Federal Reserve has been throwing around. I mean, it's not dissimilar over here. It's just that the welfare is more generous in the United States, to the point that it's absolutely obvious that it's going to cause problems in getting people to work if you're giving them so much money, and in fact you're giving them more money not to work. And this is the problem with socialism and central government planning. I mean, this whole situation now with the central banks and then the United States, the Federal Reserve there, and the Biden administration and their central planning for the economy and everything else, it is a total wrecking ball. These people, when they get into your country and they get control of the money supply, and I'm talking about Jewish central bankers, because they are, Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, is another Jew. It's just a revolving door. It was the same. Timothy Geithner was under the Bush administration. He was the president of the New York Fed, and then into the Treasury Secretary. I mean, it's the same old crap. And they wonder what could possibly go wrong. I mean, these people are against the natural order of everything, whether it be social order, ethnic order, or economic order. It's just a total wrecking ball with everything. And Janet Yellen and the Fed chairman, Powell, they just lie, because these people, even though they're Keynesians and everything else, They don't really. I just cannot fathom for a second that they are not cognizant of the destruction that they're causing. Instead, they keep talking about transitory inflation and laughably that they don't seem to, you know, because Yellen was asked last week that by some reporter. I'm amazed they even asked the question, but it's talk about the elephant in the room. That Janet, don't you think maybe that the the generosity of the government in these stimulus checks might have something to do with the shockingly low jobs report? And she just said no. I couldn't possibly see a link in that. I mean, it's staggering that the temerity of these people to stand up there and deny something as obvious as that. You know, over here, well, you know, socialism has taken, you know, it's got a grasp and a grip on the European and our economies as well. And if you think about it, and a lot of people do, I've been in this situation before myself, where you might get, say, £1,200 on the dole, you know, in a month. Or you might get a job where you're getting £1,400. And anybody will sit down and work out. And this is common. Lots of people do. It's why these are incentives for people not to work, where you think, okay, 40-hour week, getting up every morning at 7 o'clock, 7:30, going through all the rigmarole and nonsense that comes with doing a job or whatever. Maybe the commute, dealing with some difficult boss, maybe some difficult colleagues, or whatever, you know, for an extra £200 a month, because that can happen. And you look at inflation, and then you look at the salaries. I mean, I look through sales jobs over here. I've had a, you know, career and for most of my life in sales and media sales and exhibition and publishing. Basic salaries are still today 24,000, 25,000. which is what I was earning in 2000 and 2001 when I was 24, 25 years of age. Now, inflation has gone through the roof. You know, it's not even a sort of a normal sort of inflation rise because we have seen so much money printing in the last 10 years and it doesn't take into account any of that. So the wages stay the same and everything. I mean, you look at, you know, just recently the inflation is starting to be felt. There's no doubt about it. It's already been, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, inflation is the increase in the expansion of the money supply. The rising prices are a consequence of that. And you're starting to see it in the supermarkets, and you're certainly starting to see it in the commodities. Even gold and silver now have started to move, and I fear that perhaps when Janet Yellen said last week when she walked it back, of course, when the market started to sell off, but she... The mere mention that interest rates may have to be risen by Janet Yellen, that caused a sell-off. And then she walked that comment back and the market sort of recovered a little bit. But things like lumber in the last sort of couple of months has gone through the roof. I think it's just like it's an increase of 100%. Copper. Massive rise in copper. I mean, let's look at some of these companies that I look at myself. And in some of them, I've got a small position. Southern Copper, in the last week, 18% rise. Phoenix Copper, in the last week, 22.2% rise. Fair Expo, the company that basically is involved with producing and mining for iron ore, just literally gone through the roof. I started to look at this company about a month ago. It, in the last month, it's gone up 35.8%. Oil, of course, is on the rise and has been. Rio Tinto, another gold mining company, in the last week, 9% rise. In the last month, 17% rise. I mean, these are huge rises. And, of course, this is where you want to be putting your money, copper. Gold mining stocks, and that's where I'm going to put my money. And oil, I think oil's still got a long way to go. British Petroleum, I have a small position in those guys. In the last month, you know, they're involved with you know, with petroleum, obviously, and the derivatives from that. In the last month, British BP's gone up 6.5% as well. The gold mining stocks have gone up a lot as well in the last week. For example, you look at companies like Pan American Silver in the last week, gone up 5%. First Majestic hasn't really risen much in the last week, but which I'm surprised about. But anyway, you get the picture. Sentiment, another UK-based gold mining company with a nice little dividend yield just to throw in there, almost 10%. Yeah, a good company to be involved with. I've got a small position in them. In the last month, 9% rise, 10% rise in the last week. It's gone from like a pound a share to £1.20 a share. And there's a double whammy with these guys because, you know, I'm trying to, if I'm investing in companies, I'm investing mostly in gold and silver stocks, but also some oil stocks and the likes of that company. I was telling you, Fair Expo, I don't know how much further they've got to go, but I mean, I hate going into these companies, you know, when they're higher. I like to buy as low as possible, obviously. But, you know, I don't know how much further they'll go. But, you know, again, it's a double whammy with these guys as well because they've got a 3.34% dividend yield. BP have got about a 4% dividend yield. Sentiment have got a 10% dividend yield. So you've got the dividends and you've got the upside, you know, based on the macroeconomic environment that we're in, which I think is only, you know, it's going to the moon as far as I'm concerned, gold and silver stocks. And also, as I say, oil and things like copper. I don't have any copper stocks yet, but I mean, I'm limited with my financial muscle as to what I can actually get into. But I'm hoping to buy a few copper stocks this week. Anyway, I'm going to play a clip from Peter Schiff. Peter it breaks things down quite nicely, and he is breaking down this jobs report and also just the absolute circus and tragedy that is the current economic environment in the United States at the moment, and it's similar right across the UK and Europe as well, with the Bank of England and our administration over here. These are all, you know, the Conservative government. I mean, they're not really much different from a Labour government. They're all Marxist puppets at the end of the day, who stand for nothing and have their own agendas, whatever it is, economically, socially, with immigration, you name it. And then if I've got time, I'm going to break down an article in Global Research, which is basically about the vaccine passports and the depressing reality of some of the data that we now have with regards to deaths and other significant side effects from vaccines. So hopefully we'll get a chance to break that down. It's an article by Rodney Atkinson in Global Research. Vaccine passports illegal, infections and deaths after vaccines, and government and media lies, the booster myth. Now, the booster, obviously referring to the second jab that people need to have, apparently. But anyway, let's just get a breakdown for maybe 10 or 15 minutes from Peter Schiff on the jobs report and the whole, as I say, the whole tragedy of the United States economy over there, and just the absolute bold-faced lies that these central bankers and central planners stand up there and spout, and it's just incredible that they can get away with this. But I mean, they just lie more and more, so shouldn't be surprised.
Model. Now, of course, to me, nobody should really be surprised by this report, because if you look at the reason for the so-called recovery. Why is the U.S. economy recovering? Well, because a lot of people are spending money. Even people who don't have jobs are spending money. People are spending more money unemployed than they used to spend when they still had jobs. How is all this being made possible? It's being financed by massive deficit spending that is being enabled by the Federal Reserve, monetizing all this debt. You also have the added wealth effect of a stock market bubble and a real estate bubble and a cryptocurrency bubble and a bubble in everything that you could possibly think of, with the exception of gold. Now, I read into a guy the other day here in Puerto Rico who was telling me about what's happening with baseball cards. And he had just bought a baseball card, a Mickey Mantle rookie card. I forget, he paid $5-6 million for the card, some record amount. But he was telling me about what was going on in baseball cards and this phenomenal appreciation that was being seen in that one area. And this is just typical what's going on with everything that is some type of asset that has any type of scarcity, whether real or manufactured. We are flooding the economy with fiat money, and so people are spending it. But why would anybody believe that the result of that would be robust jobs growth? It's not. You don't need jobs if you're printing money. If people are just getting money from the government, what's the point of working? I mean, why bother? I mean, normally, if you want money, you have to work to earn it. But not today. Just stay at home. The government's going to send you money. So when you have an economy built on spending printed money, that type of economy doesn't require a lot of actual work. The work is being done abroad. That's where all the jobs are being added. They're being added in all the countries that are making all the stuff that we're buying with all the money that the Fed is printing. But, of course, this whole thing is temporary because now the jobs are overseas. Later, the purchasing power is going to be overseas because you cannot continue to run an economy on a printing press. The whole thing is going to collapse as soon as the dollar crashes and ends this party. And that is exactly what is going to happen. Let's also look at the average hourly earning numbers in the report. The consensus was for earnings to be flat after a drop of 0.1% in March. Instead, we rose by 0.7%. That's the month-over-month number. The year-over-year number, we were supposed to see minus 0.4, and we got up 0.3. So wages are pressured. Right, we're seeing more upward pressure on wages, even though we're not getting as many new jobs. Employers are having to pay those workers more money who who are returning to those jobs, which of course makes perfect sense given the fact that employers now have to compete with the government that is offering huge incentives not to work. For a lot of people, the return on being unemployed is far higher than the gains from being employed. So obviously, if you're an employer and you've got to convince somebody to take a job, you're going to have to pay them a lot more money now, given the alternatives that they have. You know, most people prefer leisure to work. And therefore, if the government is paying people to take vacations, well, you're going to have to pay them a lot more to give up those vacations and come into work. In fact, it's interesting because after this report was released, there was a press conference, and both President Biden and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen spoke about this report. And they both agreed that even though it was lower than expectations, and quite a bit lower, that it doesn't mean that the recovery is somehow been derailed. They think everything is fine, everything is going well, and it's a result of their stimulus and all their plans. Although they did use the lower than expected numbers to show that they still have a lot of work to do, that even though we're making progress, there's still a lot more that needs to be done. And this proves that we need this additional stimulus. We have to have Congress pass these new proposals that we have. And in fact, Biden spoke, I think, for the first time about his new plan that he calls the Biden Blue Collar Blueprint for America. A lot of B's there. Biden, blue, and blueprint. Blue collar and blueprint. But it may be a catchy name, but it's not going to produce any prosperity.
Of course, the only B that's missing is the only one that's appropriated, which is the B in BS.
You know, the idea that we build a strong economy based on government central planning. The way we get a strong economy is through a vibrant free market. The government can't build anything. I mean, the government can build bureaucracies, but bureaucracies stand in the way of prosperity and economic growth. They are barriers. They're roadblocks. If Biden really wants a blueprint to build back a stronger America for blue-collar workers, free market capitalism is the only plan that's going to work. Biden's plan is destined to fail. Every bureaucrat that's ever tried it has failed. The only thing that succeeds is free market capitalism. But Biden does not understand that. But what I want to do point out about this press conference, because both Yellen and Biden were asked if they believed that the generous extended unemployment benefits were partially to blame for.
Okay, this is a bit that I covered earlier myself. Schiff is commenting now on this as well, because it's like, it's so obvious. It's, you know.
The weak jobs report, meaning that because the government is paying workers not to go back to work, maybe workers are not going back to work because the government is paying them not to work, right? Very obvious. In fact, there's really no way to deny that these lucrative payments not to work are behind the reason that a lot of people are choosing not to work. I mean, it's just common sense. If the government's going to pay people not to work, people are going to not work to get the payments. I mean, that's not rocket science, but apparently it's beyond the scope of most economists, certainly the ones that work for government, to understand, and it's certainly beyond the grasp of Biden and Yellen, because they both denied any relation to the government paying people not to work and people deciding not to work to accept those payments. I mean, only government economists could fail to understand this obvious relationship. As I mentioned just earlier in this podcast, there is a preference for leisure over work. People would prefer to have leisure than work. The only reason they give up their leisure to work is because they need the money, because otherwise they can't pay their bills, they can't pay the rent, they can't put food on the table. So even though they would prefer leisure, they have to work. Well, if the government says, no, you don't have to work, you can have the leisure that you prefer, and we'll replace your lost income. In fact, we will actually give you more money to take a vacation than what you would earn if you gave up that vacation and went back to work. How can anybody not realize that there is a link here between these lucrative payments not to work and so many people choosing not to work? And again, I've talked about it on this podcast, it's not just that being paid more not to work is the reason that people are choosing not to work. Even if they got paid the same, they would still choose not to work. And in fact, even if the unemployment benefits are lower than what you can earn working, in many cases, people would still choose to accept less money not to work and more money to work, because there is a value to be placed on that leisure that they have to give up to take a job. Then, of course, you have all the other costs that are incurred when you have a job, all your commuting costs and things like that, that factor into the equation. So employers have to pay workers enough money to overcome the added costs of going to work and the opportunity costs of giving up all that leisure. And clearly, the cost-benefit analysis of not working versus working has been heavily skewed as a result of these generous government incentives. But it's not just, you know, common sense that would, you know, get you to conclude that this is the cause. You also have all of the anecdotal evidence. I mean, I don't know how many articles I have read, but there's plenty of them on the internet, in which they interview employers. And these employers specifically say they can't hire people because they don't want to work. They don't want to give up their lucrative deal with the government to collect unemployment benefits, and so they're turning down the jobs. And of course, not always are the employees being honest, or the potential employees. I'm sure that sometimes they don't want to say, well, the reason I don't want to go to work is because my unemployment deal is so lucrative. I bet a lot of people will say something like, well, I just don't want to work because I don't want to risk getting COVID, right? Because that's the easier thing to say, look, I don't want to risk getting COVID. But I'm sure a lot of these people who claim that going to work is too risky because they might catch COVID, I bet these same people during their free time are out and about interacting with other people in ways that are every bit as dangerous, or even maybe more so, than what would happen if they actually went to work. I mean, they are exposing themselves to the virus during their leisure. I'm sure they're not just, you know, holed up, you know, in their homes in quarantine. They're probably out and about enjoying this paid vacation. And so they have no problems with exposing themselves to the risk of getting COVID when they're out having fun. But all of a sudden, when it comes to showing up at a job and doing some work, oh, no, I can't go to work because I don't want to risk COVID. So people saying that are only saying that because they don't want to be honest and admit that they enjoy living on the dole. Although I don't know why people should be shy about admitting that they would rather not work if they don't have to. And if the government is paying you a lot of money not to work, well, then you're not going to work. So with all of this evidence out there, it is completely ridiculous for government to say that these extended unemployment benefits are playing no role in incentivizing people not to return to work. And since they have taken that ridiculous position, well, obviously, they're never going to change. Nobody in government is going to connect these obvious dots to the extended unemployment benefits and people deciding to remain unemployed. And so they're going to continue to extend them indefinitely, which means more and more people will turn this temporary vacation into a permanent vacation. Getting back to the reactions, though, to the jobs report from an investment community that was really shocked by how weak the report ended up being relative to these lofty expectations. First of all, I think that the report itself really should be a game changer for the view that the Fed is going to be surprising the markets by hiking sooner rather than later. I've been talking about that on this podcast pretty much all year. That has been the theme that has been circulating throughout the investment community, that, hey, based on how strong this recovery is, the Fed is actually going to be raising rates sooner than it is forecasting, And of course, looking around at the strength in prices, increases in commodity prices, that inflation is going to come in hotter than what the Fed expects. And so stronger growth and more inflation means that the Fed is going to move sooner rather than later with rate hikes and maybe tapering its asset purchases. And that really had supported a rise of the dollar that was acting as a big headwind for the price of gold and silver, based on the fact that the markets believed the Fed was actually going to be more hawkish than its current posture would suggest. Now, I think that this jobs report should basically put a nail in the coffin of that idea, which I never thought was a valid idea anyway. I've been saying that the markets are wrong to anticipate that the Fed is going to be more aggressive. It's going to be less aggressive. The Fed is actually going to open up the monetary spigots even wider. They're not going to fight inflation. They're going to surrender to inflation. In fact, what we're going to have is stagflation, and that's why the Fed is going to choose to create even more inflation rather than fight it, because it's going to be more concerned with the weakness in the economy rather than the strength of prices. So I expect there to be even bigger reactions to this jobs number in the weeks ahead in the currency markets, in the precious metals markets, than the reactions that we've already seen on Friday, which I will get to in a moment. But also, look at the reaction from the reporters. Look at Steve Liesman, who is the senior economic reporter for CNBC. This guy was claiming that this weak jobs report actually vindicated Powell. But this proves that the Fed is correct, that Powell's idea that, hey, we're not even going to think about raising interest rates is correct, because, see, Powell understood that the recovery is still nascent and still has a long way to go, and that the economy is not as strong as we're all thinking, that we have a lot more work to do. And this jobs report proves that the Fed is right. And this is why they're correct in letting the markets know that they're not thinking about raising interest rates, because, see, they anticipated a jobs number like this, and they know there's a lot more work to be done to get where we need to go, and therefore the Fed has to continue to provide the monetary supports to help us get there. But the reality is, this weak jobs report actually proves the opposite. What it proves is that Powell is wrong, that the Federal Reserve is wrong, and that their policies are not effective. Their policies are not creating a real economic recovery. We lost manufacturing jobs in April. Strong economies don't lose manufacturing jobs. They gain.
And of course they're lying, because what's really happening is they're in the end game of destroying the United States and destroying the dollar, sending inflation through the roof, which is going to happen. They've only two choices. They've got to raise interest rates, which will cause tremendous damage. It's not going to be like Paul Volcker, who saved the U.S. economy in the early 80s. When he raised interest rates to 20%. That is just going to cause absolute devastation. But the medicine that is, as bad as that tastes, and as difficult as that would be to take, that is actually a less painful and shorter term option in terms of the damage caused than what they're actually going to do, which is, if they keep going, they're going to cause just massive inflation and a huge amount of theft, basically, in the diminishing of the purchasing power of the dollar, to the point that that dollar could be completely destroyed. And of course, then you've got a big problem, because you've got all these dollars overseas. You've got China and all the other countries around the world which are exporting into the United States, who are not going to accept those dollars anymore. And that's going to be a total and utter disaster of epic proportions. So the Federal Reserve are literally just in the end game of destroying the United States, a century after they took control of the money supply. So that's what's happening.
Manufacturing jobs. What the Fed has succeeded in doing is creating inflation and inflating bubbles. That's it. And this jobs report is more evidence that that's all that's been accomplished. And that is why the trade deficits are exploding. It's because we're spending all the money that we're printing buying imported products. This is not legitimate economic growth. And that's not why we're not getting jobs, because you don't need real jobs for phony growth. Now, of course, the jobs have to be somewhere. Yeah, the jobs are in China. The jobs are in other countries. But eventually, the people working hard to provide Americans with products in exchange for paper are going to realize that they're patsies in this whole exchange, and they're going to stop doing it. They're going to want to consume what they produce instead of allowing Americans to consume it, and they're not going to want our paper, and the dollar is going to plunge. And another thing that this report is doing is it is basically getting people to reassess their views of inflation, right? They think, oh, the labor market is not as strong as we thought. The economy is not as strong as we thought. Maybe we don't have to be worried as much about inflation. And that's another reason why they may believe that these anticipated rate hikes are not actually going to come, because this weakness in the labor market or reduction in strength of the labor market takes the pressure off inflation. And it does not. In fact, it actually adds to it. You still have this view among economists and bankers that the Phillips curve is what determines inflation, that inflation is a function of people working, and that as long as you don't have a lot of people working, you don't have to worry about inflation. In fact, look at the comments that came out earlier in the week from Philip Lane. He is the European Central Bank's chief economist. So he's the top economist at the ECB. Look at what this guy said. Quote, prolonged weakness in the labor market will offset inflationary pressures in the Eurozone. So in other words, by having a lot of people...
I mean, that is just absolute... Not only is that absolute nonsense, but that is just pure and utter gaslighting. It's the only way you can describe that. It's economic gaslighting to say something as ludicrous as that. Anybody, a five-year-old who knows anything about the fundamentals of economics, would recognize that as the most ludicrous, absurd, ironic term you could possibly think of. But again, they have the temerity. This is all psychological warfare, and it is a form of gaslighting, because this type of audacity and lies to this level scrambles people's brains. It's so out there and so far off the truth.
Well, unemployed, it's going to offset the pressures of inflation, which is nonsense. It actually exacerbates those pressures. Look, the ECB prints a bunch of money, right? That's the inflation, right? Now, all that money in the system is going to be putting upward pressure on prices. How does fewer people working alleviate that pressure? It doesn't. More people working might alleviate that pressure to the extent that they help produce goods so that people could use that money to buy those goods. Because if we're increasing the supply of money, the only way to prevent prices from rising is to also increase the supply of goods. But if people are not working and therefore they're not producing goods, but you're printing more money, now you have even more upward pressure on prices. And if you look at the dynamic of what happens when people are unemployed, the government prints money and gives it to them. So the more people who are not employed and who are not earning a paycheck, the more people who are now dependent on government checks. And so the government has to print even more money to provide the unemployed with their benefits than they would have to print if there were fewer people who are unemployed in need of those benefits. So in all circumstances, an unemployment problem doesn't offset an inflation problem. It actually makes an inflation problem even worse. And the same thing is going to be true in the United States. The fact that the labor market is weak is going to mean that inflation is going to be even stronger than would be the case if the labor market were stronger. You know, what is really crazy about this idea that we don't have to worry about inflation as long as there's weakness in the labor market? I mean, what about the 1970s? I mean, how could you dismiss that entire period of history as if it didn't even exist? I mean, what was interesting about the 1970s is that when that decade happened originally, the economists of the day were completely surprised because they thought it was impossible. They did not believe, and these are Keynesian economists, right? So not all economists, but the Keynesian economists did not believe it was possible for high inflation and high unemployment to coexist. They believed that high unemployment would cancel out the high inflation. They believed exactly what Philip Lane, the chief economist of the ECB, believes now. That's what they believed in the 1960s. But what they learned in the 1970s was that they were wrong, right? And they came up with the name stagflation to describe this new concept that they didn't think was possible, the combination of high unemployment and high inflation. Well, once they discovered that it was possible, they came up with a name for it, and the name was stagflation. Well, since they now know it's possible because it's in the history books, why do you have the same Keynesian economists today making the same ridiculous claims that they made in the 1960s about how it was impossible to have high inflation and high unemployment at the same time when they already know it's possible because they have a name for it? In the newest season of Wondery's Business Wars, Vaccine Wars, they follow the pharmaceutical industry's unprecedented race to save lives and in the process creating a market worth billions of dollars. When the coronavirus pandemic first began, the timeline...
All right, we'll leave it there with Schiff. I want to get to this. Anyway, some good analysis and breakdown of the absurdity and utter nonsense that was the jobs report and government and central bankers' comments on the jobs report. Vaccines, government and media lies, and the booster myth. According to all UK COVID vaccine adverse reaction report, 1,086 UK citizens have died following the two COVID vaccinations, Pfizer and AstraZeneca, up to the reporting date of the 29th of April 21. Now, the media, of course, are not going to report any of this. In stark contrast, of course, to the COVID even cases, let alone people who are hospitalized or death, but these horrible cases, which is in most cases, people had no symptoms or anything, but this is all just amplified and pumped out as pure propaganda. But absolute silence on 1,086. I mean, it's, you know, that's a significant number. It might be worth commenting on, but alas, no. COVID infections following the vaccination have risen to 973 for both vaccinations, with 62 deaths. Now, that's a staggering statement, isn't it? The COVID infections following the vaccination has risen to 973 for both vaccinations, with 62 deaths. A death rate of 6.3%, which is nearly twice the rate of deaths in general from COVID. Once again, there have been big rises in lymphadenopathy, which I don't know what that is, actually. Lymphadenopathy. Let's look that up. Lymphadenopathy. Doesn't sound very nice. Lymphadenopathy. Or adenopathy, it's called as well, is a disease of the lymph nodes in which they are abnormal in size or consistency, which obviously anybody knows anything. If you've got glands and they're swollen, that's something to be concerned about. Lymphadenopathy of an inflammatory type, the most common type, is lymphadenitis, producing swollen or enlarged lymph nodes. I had some swollen glands myself the other day in my throat. But, you know, I haven't had the vaccine, of course, but so it's not from that. But, you know, if you have a cold or if you get flu or if you're a bit run down, sometimes, you know, you can have swollen glands. You, in most cases, taking a couple of ibuprofen will deal with it. But it's not a good sign if you've got prolonged periods of time to have swollen glands. Where's the article going? Lost the article. Bear with me, I'll pull it back up again. Anyway, so there's a rise in lymphadenopathy. So from the 9th of December 20 last year to the 29th of April, just gone, the end of April there, lymphadenopathy 4,319. These are cases of these things after the Pfizer vaccine. Myocardial infarction, 94, of which 17 deaths. Eye problems, doesn't be more specific than that, 2,438. Death or sudden death, 136. COVID, 599, of which 33 deaths. Spontaneous abortion, 60. Respiratory disorders, 6,520, of which 34 deaths. And then it goes on to list these things for the AstraZeneca vaccine. Lymphadenopathy, 3,515. Eye problems, 8,841. Diarrhea, 6,715. Death and sudden death, 247, which is quite significantly more than, pretty much double for the Pfizer vaccine. COVID, 374, of which 29 deaths. And respiratory disorders, 18,759. Wow, it's massive compared to the Pfizer jab, which was 6,520 with 34 deaths. The AstraZeneca has 18,759 reported respiratory disorders after taking the AstraZeneca jab. I think it's the AstraZeneca jab. There's been a lot of controversy around with blood clots as well, isn't it? I mean, yeah, I think the Germans and the French and some of the European countries have actually stopped distributing that, I believe. And then the total deaths up to the 29th of April for the AstraZeneca jab is 722. Again, you won't hear any mention about that. It's a significant number. And the total deaths for the Pfizer vaccine is 364. And that's just deaths. That's not mentioning all the other stuff. I don't know what eye problems and how severe these respiratory disorders are or the lymphadenopathy are, but it doesn't sound very healthy. So far in the UK, approximately 33 million people have received at least one vaccination from either the AstraZeneca or the Pfizer vaccine. The latter is in fact a genetic treatment. Now, unlike most vaccines, you have immunity to it, but these vaccines don't even provide immunity to it. They just suppress the worst of the symptoms. That is not a vaccine in my book. And it seems to be a point that's just gone over the heads of most of our population. That's just the, you know, minor detail category sort of thing. Oh, well. And it doesn't seem to concern people either that there is very good reason for a vaccine typically taking 6 or 7 years before it comes in the market because of extensive human trials. This vaccine has skipped those human trials, and the mass distribution of them is in fact the human trials. And people are happy to take it without even giving it a second thought that there's very good reason that these vaccines normally take 6 or 7 years. And that there's very good reason why the pharmaceutical companies producing them have liability, which has been removed in this case for these COVID jabs by the government. And again, most people just seem to sort of be, you know, just totally fine with that. No alarm bells there. It's really incredible. So you've had 33 people, and it says 33 million people have been vaccinated by either the AstraZeneca or the Pfizer jab, and it says the latter, pertaining, I presume, to Pfizer, is in fact a genetic treatment. There have been 1,086 deaths. Therefore, the chance of dying from the vaccine is 1 in 30,386. This compares very badly with the chance of those under 50 dying from COVID itself. Exactly. So you are taking a very unnecessary risk if you're under the age of 50 to take this vaccine. You're at higher risk of dying from the vaccine than you are from COVID. Think about that. Why would you take that? Why would you take that risk? If you're a healthy person, in my book, under the age of 70, why would you even take that risk? For a healthy child under 10, the chance of dying of COVID is 1 in 4 million. Or 1 in 1.3 million for a child with comorbidities. which is why so many attack the plans to vaccinate children. For healthy 10 to 19-year-olds, the chance of dying from COVID is 1 in 2.5 million. For 20 to 30-year-olds, it's 1 in 576,000. 30 to 39-year-olds, 1 in 164,000. And 40 to 49-year-olds, 1 in 46,242. Now, I wonder how those figures compare to the likes of road traffic accidents, flu, respiratory illnesses, including, you know, cancer. I wish we had those figures, to, you know, for those age groups to see what the chances are of dying. Or what about globally, starvation? I mean, I think there's, how many people die of starvation? I think it's 10 million people die globally from starvation every year. I think there's a million people die every year from polluted, you know, and infected water supply and you know, water-related illnesses, malaria and stuff like that, a million. What is the actual total death of COVID now? I mean, it's not, it's, is it a million? I don't know. I mean, it's, I guess it is globally, but, you know, that amount of people are dying from polluted water-related illnesses every single year. 10 times that amount die from starvation. Despite the clear evidence from the above statistics, the UK's national statistic in reply to an April question from Philip Davis MP asking, how many and what proportion of people have died within 28 days of receiving a COVID-19 vaccination? And whether those people will all be considered to have died as a result of that vaccination, because, of course, he's pointing out there that people who have died, and again, this is a point that is, just seems to have been overlooked by the vast majority of people, if they're even aware of it. Now, the BBC, when they're pumping out their propaganda and fear, have, in small print, when they're producing the death figures for the week or whatever it is during, you know, which has basically gone down to, but I think last week there was one of the days where the total death toll from COVID here in the UK was a grand total of one. And that's assuming that that was actually someone who died directly of COVID rather than with COVID, which is my point here, because, and this is the MP's point here, is because COVID deaths are anybody who died within 28 days of testing positive for COVID. So, in other words, if you tested positive for COVID at the beginning of April, at the end of April, you died in a road traffic accident, that is recorded as a COVID death. That is the absolute scandal at work here. So by asking this question, this MP is nodding to that scandal. He says, how many people and what proportion of people have died within 28 days of receiving a COVID vaccination? Turning it on its head, because you're seeing this complete inconsistency, and a lot of this, ironically, and it's the complete opposite when they're reporting on the vaccinations, it's a suppression of the truth when it comes to this issue, because what they'll say is, oh no, they died with other things. It just so happened that they died with having had the vaccine, not of it. Which, as far as I understand it, it's completely the opposite again of the truth of the vaccine, because more often than not, people died with COVID, not of it, and people are dying more directly with, and as a result, direct result as a result of taking the vaccine, and not dying of other things, and it just so happened that it's a coincidence that they took the vaccine. And the data coming out of India seems to be very clear that there is a strong, at the very least, correlation between people who've been vaccinated and people dying. So Philip Davis asks, how many and what proportion of people have died within 28 days of receiving a COVID-19 vaccination, and whether those people will all be considered to have died as a result of that vaccination? Surprised the question was even asked. Replied with, at the best, disingenuous answer, up to the end of February 2021, there were zero deaths registered with the aligning ICD codes for this. Just lies. Clearly avoiding any mention of the 1,086 deaths set out in government statistics above. The deliberate cover-up of even official statistics about vaccines has been most blatantly demonstrated in the USA, where Democrat Party attorney generals from 12 states wrote to the CEOs of Twitter and Facebook asking them to censor any negative claims about vaccines. They claim that the official and compulsory VAERS report of vaccine deaths, infections, and injuries are, quote, falsehoods and, quote, misleading, unquote. And they claim the right to know the truth. The fascist arrogance of these pseudo-elites is quite breathtaking. They know the truth, and the people are just imagining the problems, the way he's put the know and in truth in quotes. So they know the truth, and the people are just imagining these problems. They just, quote, imagine the 2,400 vaccine deaths officially reported in the USA. Dr. Mike Yeadon reports that the US VAERS reporting system is, quote, telling us that almost 99% of deaths reported to VAERS after vaccination occurred after COVID-19 vaccination. Now, this is very controversial when you had Dr. Mike Yeadon's coming out and commenting on this, because he is the ex-CEO of Pfizer himself. Or he was the ex, I forget what his actual position was, but he was high up in the Pfizer pharmaceutical company. So Dr. Mike Yeadon reports that the US VAERS reporting system is, quote, telling us that almost 99% of the deaths reported to VAERS after vaccination occurred after COVID-19 vaccination. The balancing 1% were for all the other vaccines combined. Or the 1,086 reported vaccine deaths in the UK. The people are, after all, ignorant and stupid. They also seek to hide the inconvenient truth that the, quote, approved vaccines are, in fact, not licensed at all and are only, quote, approved for emergency use, unquote, until they have fulfilled their complete trial process, which will not be before, before 2023. There has never been a coronavirus vaccine developed before, and there has never been an mRNA vaccine administered before this year. By now, most will be wary of the heading, quote, fact check, since the writers will certainly have an agenda which makes their own facts in need of checking. This Reuters fact check is a complete lie. First, they deny the vaccines are experimental, when the US FDA has designated them for, quote, emergency use only, and confirmed licensing processes will not conclude until 2023. But then say that animal experiments are being done alongside human vaccinations. In other words, what would normally be done before humans are exposed is being done in parallel. And the experiments in animals they refer to report purely resistance to the virus, not deaths of animals and other adverse effects. Let's read that again. And the experiments in animals they refer to report purely resistance to the virus, not deaths of animals and other adverse effects. This kind of half-truth and manipulation is typical of most, quote, fact-check reports. Not long ago, Boris Johnson said, quote, there is absolutely no question of people being asked to produce certification or COVID status report when they go to the shops or to the pub garden or to the hairdressers or whatever on Monday, on the 12th of April this year, he said. At the turn of the year, speaking to Sky News, Cabinet Official Minister Michael Gove reassured everyone that vaccine passports will not be necessary to go to the pub. A vaccine passport in order to go to the pub? Asks Kay Burley. Michael Gove says no, quote. And yet now the government, through a House of Commons committee, is considering vaccine passports. I mean, there's an old saying, you know, when the government denies something three times, you can guarantee it's going to happen. For months, the government and the BBC have been recording thousands of new COVID cases, which are not cases in the sense used in the first wave, but infections, and many of those are either without symptoms or false positives. Equally false are the death statistics, which show that a small fraction of reported COVID deaths were from COVID itself. Both the US CDC and Italian researchers have shown that only 6 to 12% of actual COVID deaths have been unambiguously from COVID. Yeah, so whatever figures they're actually churning out as death for figures, according to the US CDC and Italian researchers, there's only about 6% to 12% have been unambiguously from COVID. So you're looking at, you know, roughly, say, 10% of the death toll, and you can apply that with most governments as well, but certainly among Western governments, about 10% of the official figures, and I think we've brought it down. At one point, there was significant data released where we actually reduced our figures down a bit from 120,000 to about 90,000. But the reality is, according to these figures, is that we have about 12,000 deaths from COVID, which are actually attributed to COVID. But let's double the figure of deaths to 240,000. That still is not justification for the absolute carnage that the government's reaction to this on the economy, on small businesses, on social factors, people's mental health, all the rest of it. Anyway, that's an article. I'm going to leave it there. An article very much worth some just absolutely shocking information in that article from Global Research by Rodney Atkinson. It's called Vaccine Passports Illegal, Infections and Deaths After Vaccines, Government and Media Lies and the Booster Myth. So I got through about two-thirds of that, but we're running out of time. Join me, please, in an hour on Republic Broadcasting Network on with Richard Carey, Beyond the Official Narrative. I will be there. That's live from midday Central Time to 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time, and here in the UK where I am, 6 p.m. through till 7 p.m. So I hope you can join me there and have a wonderful day. And, this is very precarious times, and we're not really going to want to give health advice or economic advice, but I think you can conclude from my views that it's an unnecessary risk to take that Pfizer or AstraZeneca jab. You have more chance, according to those stats, if you're under 50, of dying from the vaccine than you have of dying from COVID. A shocking stat, really, when you consider the amount of hysteria that we've had around COVID and the, silence around any dangers of these vaccines. But alas, us, we're dealing with governments who are hell-bent on destroying your life. And we sadly still live in a climate where we have naive little children running around everywhere who seem to think that ultimately governments only make mistakes and are well-intentioned and have our best interests at heart, and are just constantly year after year and administration after administration just incompetent. It really beggars belief, doesn't it, to think that people can be that naive to give these Marxist demons the benefit of the doubt. But there we are. Take care, and join me next week again. That will be the 17th. Bye now.